episode 41, Patrick and Cyprian speak with returning guest Fred Chong of the University of Chicago. Among other topics, the team discussed the acquisition of Supertech by Colt Quanta, the benefits of software development companies working directly with hardware manufacturers, and neutral atom architecture. Welcome to Entangled Things, your quantum computing podcast, hosted by Patrick and Cyprian.
Hey, Cyprian, how you doing?
Hi, Patrick. Doing very well and looking forward for another great episode of Entangled Things.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about some cool topics, and I know you've got a heat wave going over there in your side of the Atlantic. So we're joined by Fred Chong again. Can you reintroduce yourself to our audience? You're our first repeat guest, which means you haven't learned your lesson. So.
No, I definitely enjoyed my first visit. So I'm the Seymour Goodman Professor of Computer Science at the University of Chicago, and I'm also the Chief Scientist for Quantum Software at Colt Quanta.
Now, that's a change. Last time, that was a different name. So there's been some exciting news from what I understand. Can you tell us what's been going on?
Yeah, absolutely. So originally, I was the co-founder and chief scientist of our startup company called Supertech. And Supertech is a quantum software company that really focuses on taking algorithms and applications and making them as efficient as possible on physical machines. And about 6 months ago, we started working with Colt Quanta, where we actually wrote a compiler, mocked a prototype compiler for them. And that's what we do. We target machines and try to make them as efficient as possible. And then Colt Quanta actually approached us with the interest in acquiring us, which is a little of a surprise. We're a young company. And initially, actually, that's not what we were looking for. We're a multi-platform software company, and we weren't necessarily looking to be acquired by a hardware company. But after some discussion, we realized that it was a really great thing. There were a few things, actually many things, that went into this decision, which is, the first was that as a software company that really wants to get the best performance out of a hardware platform, we realized that we do our best when we know the details of a hardware platform, and being part of a hardware company really gave us incredible access to the engineering details of that machine, and even allowed us to affect the design of that machine. So that was a great partnership. And then we thought, well, should it be Colt Quanta, right? Like, there are many technologies out there. And in fact, I'm very positive about neutral atom technology, the Colt Quanta technology. Just in short, it's sort of like it's a technology that combines the advantages of two of the leading technologies right now, right? Essentially, it has a scalability of superinducting machines, but each qubit has the consistency of an atom, of an atomic machine, such as a trapped ion machine, right? And so it is a technology that's still in development. It's just emerging, right? But it seemed to us like a technology of the future that was going to be a winner as we go forward. So then because of that made Colt Quanta very appealing to us, the particular technology. And then we learned more, we became even more excited, because Colt Quanta is actually a multi-platform hardware company, right? They build a neutral atom computer, right? They just announced that a month ago. But they also sell parts. This is actually how I first heard about them, to other quantum computing companies. They're one of the best manufacturers of different quantum computing parts for trapped ion machines, for neutral atom machines.
Oh, wow.
And so they have a business already where they sell parts. And in fact, they're even more multi-platform than that, because the cold atom technology that they have is used in atomic clocks, which they make. They make some of the best atomic clocks. They make sensors. They make communication platforms. And so before the acquisition, we went out to visit them out in Boulder, and we visited their different divisions, and we were just super impressed by all the technology that they make. And so the multi-platform aspect of it, what was interesting about that is culturally, they want us, Supertech, now that we're part of Colt Quanta, to continue our multi-platform software products. products, which means that, you know, we're not just going to be targeting cold quantum machines. We're still going to be targeting all the machines in the industry. And so that really appeals to us. And then the final thing is, it turns out that, you know, as a company, a software company that is very tied to the physics of machines, we have a lot of physicists on staff, or actually people who are both physicists and computer scientists. And they were super excited to become part of a company where they could also work on atomic clocks and sensors and things like that. And so in the end, it was just an incredible partnership for us to become part of Cold Quantum.
It sounds like there's lots of synergy there. I'm struck by the idea that a lot of people will start a business and they have a direction in mind and they're inflexible, and that leads to the defeat of accomplishing anything. And I'm struck by a quote from one of my old mentors, and he used to often say, most people would rather fail alone than succeed with help. And it sounds like this is really opening up a lot of resources for you and a lot of insight to be able to solve the problem that you want to solve.
Absolutely. And you know, it is an incredible partnership, because from our side, it really really gives us access to an incredible range of technologies and an incredible set of engineers. And from Cold Quanta's side, you know, I'm really impressed that they are a hardware company that thought to invest early in software, right? As a computer architect who, by training classically, you know, I'm involved in a lot of sort of hardware efforts, and the typical trap of a hardware effort is you build the machine, and then you finish the machine, you thought, oh no, we don't have any software, right? And you know, it really takes a lot of foresight. And in fact, the CEO of Cold Quanta was originally previously involved in Luminar, which is a LiDAR company. And he was telling me that, you know, he did the same thing with Luminar, invested early in software, and it really paid off, right? And so I think that really shows a lot of vision and determination to do the right thing.
Yeah, that's it. Leadership is often the act of looking down the horizon to make sure you're doing the thing so that everything arrives at the same time. The Army, the Navy, the Marines all land at the same time. Because if the Coast Guard shows up before the Army, you know, it doesn't work very well.
Exactly.
There is that hardware versus software mentality. Now, Cyprian and I are both software programmers from way back. And, you know, Cyprian's a data scientist. I'm more of a cyber guy. But programming is really our bread and butter. And you've got some courses through University of Chicago, through edX, that I'm definitely going to check out. One is the Quantum Computer Systems Design 1. I'm definitely looking forward to taking that. Is that the way that you guys are trying to enable programming? Or what else should we be doing to be ready to write the software for when the hardware guys arrive?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it is a certain mindset that really a whole field of development and research that we're trying to grow. This work, the company and this approach actually grew out of a large research project funded by the Natural Science Foundation, called An Expedition in Computing. And that project is where we started to do this work, where we were building software that's very tied to the physics of machines and really requires people that are trained in both computer science and physics. And we wrote a textbook, which sort of tries to train people in this idea that you can use classical software techniques to optimize and make quantum computers and systems better, right? And that's what the book is about, and that's what the course is. There are actually three. There's 1, 2, and 3 quantum computer systems design. 1, 2, and 3. There are 3 parts to it, and it allows you to program machines, and it allows you to look at, you know, how do you take your program and put it on the machine on all the right qubits, and how do you schedule it? How do you optimize circuits? How do you make errors less of a problem? So those are all sort of the basic things that you would want to do if you started working with one of these real machines and writing software for it.
So what struck me interesting, right, is when you are, at least in the quantum space, when you are kind of preparing to allow folks to write software before the hardware actually arrives, right? You will typically need like three things, right? One would be you will need estimators because folks need to understand like what is the amount of resources, right? You will need simulators because you will need to simulate, right, before the actual hardware arrives, and then you actually need the hardware, right? So I'm curious, like is this the same type of approach that you folks are taking, providing estimators, providing simulators, and then kind of supporting the underlying hardware as well?
That's definitely true. Although I would say that SuperTech, now called Quanta, we do have an emphasis on real machines because when we try to optimize for the actual properties of the machines, the simulators tend not to be that accurate. And so you really want to get on the real machine. That being said, the simulators and estimators are important tools in the development cycle, you know, where you want to sort of work, sort of develop your software first on those things often, and then sort of tune it on the real machine. So we do have a bit of an emphasis on a real machine, but I think as machines become more mature and as we project into future generations of machines, we will, I think, have a more balanced emphasis on all three of those techniques that you mentioned.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm also thinking here, right, when you talk about having an emphasis on the physical machines, right? Do you also need, for example, to, let's say, taking into account the properties of the physical machine, simulate for, let's say, more qubits than the machine currently supports?
Yes.
Because that's one of the areas, right, that are always kind of like, okay, do we have enough physical qubits? We don't. What will happen if we would have X amount of physical qubits and so forth?
That's right. And in fact, so I'm trained as a classical computer architect. And what computer architects do is always this bootstrapping process of, you know, how do we design the next machine, right? And the next machine is always bigger and faster and different from, you know, scaling in a way from the current machine. And it's always difficult to simulate, in fact. And so we always have to develop a set of simulators and models, which are, you know, small and accurate up to large and approximate, right? And that's that family of three things you talked about, right? And so we are developing the theory and the framework for how to calibrate these things together and create, you know, more accurate estimators so we can project into the future. And that's exactly what we do. I mean, I can give you a really interesting example, which we actually, in some prescient way, worked on before we were acquired by Cold Quanta. I worked on an academic study on neutral atoms. And so we studied the properties of neutral atoms and, you know, what were the advantages and disadvantages and how would you use that in your architecture and your software. And we used, you know, a suite of simulators and estimators to study that. And so, in fact, what we found was, you know, I mentioned this idea that these machines have sort of the scalability of say superconductors, but some of the nice properties of ions. And one of the things they can do is in a superconducting machine, you can only communicate with your neighbor, whoever you're wired to, right? If you're a qubit. In a trapped ion machine, you can actually take the atoms, imagine they're in a 2D sort of structure, like a rectangular structure, a grid. And instead of just communicating with your neighbor, you can actually communicate two or three or even more away by exciting the atoms in a different way. And that's what we think of as, you know, as an architect, that's long distance communication, right? Instead of just one away, two or three away. And what we found was, you know, if you can communicate, say, three away, then you save yourself so many operations in your program, right? Because normally you would have to sort of swap the qubits around and get them next to each other, that the reliability of your operations can actually be 10 times less, and you would still get the same accuracy in your computing. So basically, that new property makes it so that you're sort of 10x ahead in your operations, your gates, your quantum gates. And that's really important because it turns out that, of course, this is a new technology, so there's a lot of engineering to be done. And initially, maybe the gates aren't as good as, say, superconducting gates, right?
Yeah.
Because there's been you know, at least 5 good years of engineering, really 20 years of engineering behind that. This is where a new technology can sort of leapfrog an incumbent technology because it has some, you know, really novel advantage, even though there's an engineering challenge in bringing that to maturity, right? And so that was a really interesting property. And we actually found, there's sort of no free lunch. There's an interesting thing about neutral atoms, which is because they're neutral, instead of so trapped ion machines, the ions are charged. And so you can actually hold them in place really well because they have a charge. The neutral atoms, they're held in place by these things called optical tweezers, held in place by lasers. And one of the things that can happen is you can lose them. They're not trapped in place as well as the trapped ions, but they're nicer because you can have a two-dimensional array instead of just a single line for trapped ions, right? But it turns out that you can what they usually do is they stop the machine, they put new atoms in, and they smoosh them back together and get a nice array again when there are holes in it, right? But we found that you could actually fix that in software. What you do is you just find out where the holes are, and then you just skip over the holes. Like you write your software in your compiler to adjust for the fact there are holes in your array.
For the defects.
That's right, they're defects. And in fact, it is what they call atom loss. And in fact, this advantageous property of being able to communicate two or three away allows you to skip over at really no cost, right? And so the advantage actually mitigates the disadvantage, and the whole system ended up being very appealing in this like first academic study we did about 2 years ago, actually. In fact, in some sense, when Cold Quanta approached us, we were like, oh yeah, neutral atoms are pretty cool, you know. So that's sort of an illustration of both what we do, the tools you mentioned, how do we do that, and the particular technology that, you know, now I'm going to be spending a little bit more time thinking about.
And maybe just a quick reminder to our audience, right? When we talk about neutral atoms, right? Neutral atoms are atoms that have an equal numbers of electrons and protons, right? So essentially they act like they have no charge.
That's right. That's right.
Just to make sure that everybody's kind of following us with the terminology.
Yeah, thanks for that. And you know, the when we talk about trapped ion machines, which, you know, are deployed right now, those ions have a charge and they're trapped electromagnetically because they have a charge. Yeah. But they're trapped in a line, and that's sort
of... So it's kind of single dimension.
That's right. And so it's harder. You can only build so big of a line of them, right? Maybe let's say 50 of them in a row, and then you have to like build separate ones and connect them together. So this ability to build a two-dimensional array with the neutral atoms is really appealing.
This raises an interesting question. Like, do you foresee a possibility sometimes in the future to even move this structure to a three-dimensional approach?
Absolutely. It can actually be three-dimensional. That I would say the engineering for that is definitely more challenging. So that's not the current goal, but certainly in theory, it could be three-dimensional. You need some other, there's some complexity there, right? So in two dimensions, you manipulate the array and then you have a camera that looks at the atoms, and they, when you try to get the data out, some of the atoms glow and some of them don't, and you detect the photons, so you get an image with bright spots, right? Now, if you have a three-dimensional array, you're going to have to do something tricky because you can't see
those photons need to navigate that structure, right?
Right, so there, but it can be done, and so, you know, that's just one of the simple, you know, things that would be more challenging for into three dimensions. But three dimensions definitely will give you like more density, right? Everything's closer together, you get a lot more atoms. So there are some nice advantages. And it wouldn't be surprising to me if in the long run we did go that way. But I think that in the near term, 2D, two dimensions is enough. And, you know, and that's, you know, the best approach to build a sort of practical, reliable system. And we'll,
most of the classical computing buildup is essentially two-dimensional, right? So, and we've done quite a good job with that, right?
Yeah, well, classical machines are becoming substantially 3D, although I think we call it 2.5D because it's like more in one two dimensions than the third one. But they are substantially stacked up now. And that's been a long time in coming. I think, you know, 20 years ago, we were talking about 3D and we're like, oh, how great would it be if we had 3D? But it really took a while before the engineering trade-offs were such that we really needed to go that way.
Becomes commercially viable. Yeah,
and that the 2D became, you know, less viable, right, over time, and then 3D became more competitive. But for a long time, sort of the 2D approach, you know, kept going and was very efficient and well-engineered, right? So this is, I think this would be a similar thing, that it would be a while before we decided that, you know, 2D was a little tapped out and we needed to have more in the array.
So that's all very fascinating. I did want to, before we run out of time, get to benchmarking. And I know that there's a lot that you've got to say about, you know, what's going on in that field. I don't think we got to it on our last episode. What's exciting about the field of benchmarking in quantum right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when these machines started coming online a few years ago, there were some very, very simple metrics proposed for how do you, you know, measure how well a machine is doing. And the one that you'll hear a lot is quantum volume, right? And so quantum volume is a very simple metric that just looks at, you know, how well can the machine run a simple computation? And it distills the performance of the machine into one metric, right? Sort of one number. And quantum volume sort of naturally was outgrown by the machines. There's actually sort of an exponential part of quantum volume. So as the machines get bigger, the number gets bigger and bigger. And then when it got to like millions, it sort of sounded sort of ridiculous. And it was really sort of designed for the early days of small machines. And so then, you know, there, I think INQ has proposed something called algorithmic qubits, which also distills things down to a single number. What we started doing about a year ago when we were still SuperTech is we created a benchmark suite called SuperMark. And what SuperMark does is it takes a whole bunch of different application areas and it creates little kernels that represent those areas. But then those programs, those kernels, can actually be scaled from very small machines that we have today to future very large machines. And the reason we made SuperMark actually is as classical computer architects, we've had, you know, 30 years of a very strong tradition of how to benchmark machines, right? And we wanted to bring that methodology to quantum computing. And how we did that was we produced this framework. You know, it's motivated by applications, and then it wanted to be scalable from small machines to big machines. But then also we had some interesting science there. We took each application and we broke it down into something called a feature vector. It's sort of like a fingerprint for the application. It has different features, right? How long is the circuit, something we call the critical path? How much parallelism is in it? How many things can you do at the same time? Some quantum features, how much entanglement does it use? So how quantum is it, basically? How much communication does it use? So we made these different sort of machine features like that the application or benchmark stresses. And then we created these little fingerprints, which basically shows you how much is there in each one of those things. And so we uniquely created fingerprints for different applications. And we tried to pick applications areas that had very different fingerprints so they cover the space, right? And so and then we further took the science to another level where we ran these benchmarks on all these different machines. And then we looked at how well does the fingerprint predict how well it would run on a machine? What parts of the fingerprint were essentially statistically correlated with the performance on the machine? And that ended up being a really interesting academic paper that we wrote that, in fact, just a couple months ago, one best paper out of 300 papers at a major computer architecture conference.
Congratulations.
I think it was the first quantum paper that had won best paper at that conference, which includes all of computer science or computer architecture and classical.
Wow.
So it was an interesting thing. So that gives the suite some academic credibility. But really what distinguishes it, you know, this was a joint project between my research group and the company. And it was an incredible partnership because the company produced like industrial strength software that compiled all of the applications, translated them to all the different machines that we could access on the cloud, and sort of automatically gathered all this data. And we could just constantly rerun and look at these different machines in a very deep way and gather much more statistics, much more data than we would have as just our academic group. And in the end, this SuperMark benchmark suite, I think, has really been popular, has had a lot of exposure. We get a lot of feedback that people want to use it, both to evaluate their machines and from companies who want to get into quantum to think about if their application would run well on different machines. So it's been a really exciting effort. And for me, it also was an incredibly good example of how to have a partnership between academic research and sort of a more industrial strength software development.
Yeah, I'm regularly struck by the fact that we're gaining so many advantages in the quantum world from having the experiences of the classical and knowing what came before. And I think a lot of things are being positioned in advance. So instead of Lewis and Clark, where we're going out in an area that nobody from our tribe has been, it's more like, we're going down the superhighway and we know where all the Walmarts are. And,
Yeah, in fact, this is a very common theme in quantum computation where we hope that we learn something from the last 70 years of classical computing so that we don't have to relearn all those things for quantum computing, right? And so we're constantly trying to think about how can we translate the things that we already know into this domain, but not overdo it, right? Because we don't want to force the things that we've constructed for classical computing into the quantum realm. An example of that, for example, is that quantum software traditionally is structured very much like classical software. And that's exactly where SuperTech does things differently. Because we try to expose a lot more of the physics to the software. Whereas, you don't think about how transistors work when you write classical software, but we do actually think about think at that level for quantum software, because at this particular time, we really need much better performance than we can get if we don't think about that.
So I really like how you use the term "we hope we would learn from the last 70 years of classical computing." That was a very nice touch, and I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, well, you have to have some humility here because nobody can predict the future. And, sometimes you look back and you think, what were we thinking?
Right? It seems like there's some bruises in your background that warranted that attitude.
Yeah, well, actually not too many. People often ask me, how were you so good at predicting the future in the things you've worked on? I started in quantum like 25 years ago. And my answer has always been, it's just lucky. I only work on things just because I think they're fun. Mm. And then they end up being really important.
Right? So I was talking, I gave a lecture yesterday, an introduction to quantum to a group of programmers. And one of the things I told them is, I said, when you get a new buzzword, you get a new, hot technology that comes out, usually one of several different impediments face that area. One is it's so new, it's still developing, it's still moving. Or the other is that it's, really math or science dependent and really complicated. And another is that it's just, there's big gaps in what it can and can't do and how it's going to be used. And quantum has all of those. It has just one.
You're right. When you were saying that, I was like, yep.
And so unlike, when machine learning hit the scene, data science, if you go back, they all tended to have one of those failings. Quantum is the only one I know of that has all of them. And so it's a challenge for people.
It is challenging. I think that there are substantial efforts to build up the workforce and make it more accessible.
Yeah.
I do believe that you can get into the area without a lot of physics or math. And there have been efforts there. There's this something called the Q12 partnership, which is something from the Office of Science. It's run here out of the University of Chicago and University of Illinois. And it looks at how to, from K to 12, how to try to introduce students to quantum concepts, and by necessity, without a lot of math and physics in the beginning. And so there have been some really interesting efforts there. And then going forward, you know, there was recently a book written by a software engineer at Google who, you know, wrote like sort of the software engineer's primer to quantum computing. That's by Robert Hunt, in case you're wondering. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I have my a book, which is a little more advanced than that, but also designed for computer scientists and not mathematicians or physicists, which really focuses on, you know, as we mentioned before, this edX series, which focuses on computer scientists getting in the field, software engineers getting into the field. So I think that first impediment is getting better. We're working on that. I think the impediment of, you know, it can't do all the things, and you can't experiment or run things on them. That's also getting better. You know, IBM did us a great favor by, you know, creating the quantum cloud a few years ago, letting people experiment. I mean, they have hundreds of thousands of users, right? And that's huge exposure. And as you know, there's an Amazon clouds, Microsoft cloud, as these things come up, right? And more machines become available, I think accessibility will get a lot better. And then what Cyprian mentioned was, you know, this idea of creating powerful families of simulators that can go forward and run things that are maybe bigger than the current machines. You know, NVIDIA got into this area with this Q-Quantum, and they have, you can run their simulator on GPU clouds, right? Mm-hmm. And that gives you some capability to project forward into machines that maybe don't quite exist yet. And so I think that also is getting a lot better. So yeah, it is funny that quantum has all these challenges, but it's definitely the case that the world is trying hard to make it more accessible. And that's, in fact, a national initiative.
Right? Yeah. When I've talked about it, I tend to tell people, if you like Marvel and other sci-fi movies, just suspend disbelief when I talk about superposition and entanglement, and just don't go like Einstein and his buddies and say, that can't be the case. Mm-hmm. It's proven. Just accept it. And then you don't have to spin your wheels as long. But that's the biggest impediment, I think. I think we're running low on time. It's been great to talk to you again. Hopefully we haven't succeeded in scaring you away, so you'll come join us again. But really honored to have you as our first repeat guest, and it's always great to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, always a pleasure. This has been a great conversation, and happy to be back.
Absolutely, that was a real pleasure to have you back. So
thanks, everybody.
It's always so much fun to talk to you.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time on Entangled Things.